I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. To start with, my name's Amelia Abraham. I'm an author. I wrote a book called Queer Intentions, which is over there, and We Can Do Better Than This. They look very garish next to the Fitzgeraldo and infinitely less chic, but there we go. And I write mostly about LGBTQ plus politics and culture and queer visual culture, and also sometimes about gender and sex. So, yeah, I'm actually working on a book about sex next, so I was very interested to read your book, and I think I would have probably read it anyway as research, so that's nice. So to introduce Polly, Polly Barton is a Japanese literary translator. Her translations include, we did agree that I wouldn't list all of them, but we'll just list to you, Where the Wild Ladies Are by Aiko Matsuda, There's No Such Thing as an Easy Job by Kikuko Tsumura. She won the 2019 Fitzcarraldo Editions Essay Prize for 50 Sounds. 50 Sounds is a memoir about the quietly revolutionary act of learning, speaking, and living in another language. So this is your second book, Porn and Oral History.
Yes.
I absolutely loved it. It was great. It made me think a lot. And Megan Nolan described it in the following way. Barton's candid, generous style as an interlocutor allows her subjects to move fluidly between their sometimes contradictory instincts and intellectual approaches in a way which feels revelatory and totally honest and human. And I just wanted to read that out because totally honest and human, I think, captures the book very, very, very well. So tonight we'll have a chat for about 45 minutes and then we'll have a Q&A. So feel free to ask questions, which Polly either will or won't answer, depending on how personal or controversial they are. And I think that's everything, other than just to say that I think the nature of this conversation will be quite free-flowing, and maybe, like the book itself, raise questions, maybe even more than providing answers, because we are not experts on porn. Although in some moments of my life, I'm very excited actually to talk about porn in the LRB. Last time I was here, I told a story about drugs that really sort of shamed myself, and I feel that I can outdo that at some point during this conversation. In a nutshell, the story was that I had taken a bag of drugs that I found on the floor of a nightclub, which I then left the LRB and was like, I can't believe I said that at the LRB. And once again,
I've done it twice now.
But I think that this sets the tone for the evening. We can have a candid conversation about
honest
porn.
And human.
Yeah. Okay. So to start with the book, you kind of talk in the introduction about how you were reticent to write a book about porn, and partly because you were worried about sort of being affiliated forever with porn and being the person who wrote a book on porn, and not even necessarily because porn is considered sort of sleazy or taboo, and we'll go into that more later, but because of that, because it's considered by many people as anti-feminist. Do you want to talk about how you sort of pushed through that reticence and you actually came to decide to make this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I felt that reticence
for a number of different reasons. You know, one of them being that my day job is as a translator, and 50 Sounds felt kind of quite in line with that in some way. Whereas porn is very far from that. You know, I'm really not an expert on it. And the book kind of tries to embrace that lack of expertise. But there's still something, you know, when when we were introduced earlier and Claire said, "This is Polly Button, she's here to talk about porn." And there's a pause and I'm like, "What? Am I?" I still can't. Yeah. But yes, in terms of the sense of what am I saying when I publish a book with porn as the title and my name on the front cover, I think there's so many kind of shifting things that come up, like the fear that people will think that I really love porn, the people, you know, the fear that people will think I'm virulently anti it, the fear that really people will think that I sort of have a fixed position on it. Mm-hmm. And the book really came from the desire to explore that lack of fixed position and to understand, to sort of break the silence and break the sense that I had that I couldn't begin those conversations if I didn't have an established position mm-hmm. already or hadn't read up about it. And it came from there. In terms of working through that, I suppose it was just a question of momentum, really. You know, I started having the conversations and they were great. They were so much more fun than I was expecting and so much more sort of liberating. And then I started transcribing them. And at the point that I started transcribing them, I kind of realized, okay, I'm not going to write these up into polished essays. Like, these need to be preserved in their original format, really, to keep that kind of the rawness. And also just from an ethical perspective, I didn't really feel like I had the right to take the testimony that people had entrusted me with and you know, put my own lens on it. And so then I was there and I was like, okay, this is it. I'm doing it. I'm doing it as interviews. And I think that throughout that time, like, the honest truth is I was feeling mostly okay with it during the day. And then I would wake up with these like terrible night terrors about publishing a book that had porn on the title. But in a way, again, in the daytime, I would think about that and think, well, that's all the more reason that
you should.
I should. Because here we are in a sort of so-called, I don't know, you know, most of the people that I hang out with are relatively progressive. Mm-hmm. And yet it just doesn't seem like something that people talk about.
Yeah. But it's a book about a lot more than porn in a way. I mean, it's a book about all the things that porn is connected to, because so many things come up, like fetishes, and it's about a little bit about, you know, capitalism, race, very, very much about gender. So
yeah,
it's such a big topic in a way. I wonder that sort of doing it in this format, you've done yourself a favor, because it's such a big topic, it's very difficult to tackle. And I wonder if the format was a way of also saying a lot of people have taken on that task of tackling it. And when they have done so, they've seen porn as such an expansive thing. I think there's a quote from Pamela Paul that you will remember that I don't.
Pornification of society.
And just like, I think when you talk about Audre Lorde or Paul Preciado, when these people talk about porn, it's like porn is everything everywhere.
Yeah.
It's such a broad topic.
Yeah.
And that comes across in the book, I think.
Yeah. Thanks. I hope that it does. A lot of people have said to me, this book isn't about porn, it's about X.
Yeah.
And that X is a number of different things, like relating to people and intimacy. And
shame.
Shame
is a big one.
Yeah. Talking to people. It's about having conversations with people about taboo subjects. Someone said to me recently, why did you do it about porn and not masturbation?
Right. There's probably already a book about masturbation
and oral history. Yeah, no, I don't know.
I feel like someone's done that.
Yeah. I think it is a huge topic. I think I knew going into it that it was a huge topic, but my sense of just how huge it was only increased as it went on. And I think in a way that was a really helpful realization to have, because it again sort of reaffirmed this sense of like, this cannot be comprehensive and that should not be an aim of mine. And sort of having that from the outset really helped. Yeah. And then that also then made me feel more okay about kind of preserving those diversions that the conversations took into, like, gender, relationships, et cetera, et cetera.
Veering off in different directions.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like people or critics maybe could be frustrated at this format of, you know, it's not been edited, but you do explain very clearly. Sorry, it has been edited, but you've published the conversation verbatim is what I mean. Yes. And also frustrated at ambivalence. I know that because my first book is also very ambivalent. It's about the mainstreaming of queer culture. And I don't get to an answer on that because there's no answer as to whether that's a good or a bad thing. There's good and there's bad. And so I can empathize. And then we were talking just before as well about how some people have been a little frustrated at the title, perhaps, because it does sound, you just said it's not comprehensive and you explained that very clearly in the introduction, but I guess it does sound comprehensive. Do you want to talk a little bit about the title, other than the fact it's a great pun, which I didn't really like pick up on until a friend pointed it out. I was like, oh yeah, porn and oral history, great. Oral history, let's talk about that.
I mean, I think that oral history is huge, again, and it means many different things to different people. Mm-hmm. You know, you have kind of oral history as it is practiced in a relatively academic, as an academic discipline, where, you know, my understanding is that everything has to be 100% verbatim. So every hesitation, you know, is recorded in some way. And then you have like someone like Svetlana Alexievich, who, you know, my assumption is that the people, you know, her interlocutors were not speaking in polished monologues. Like, she was asking them questions, but she's redacted herself from those. And it's, you know, extremely effective, but it is a kind of a refined form, a polished form, I suppose. And then I think there's this interesting question of like, well, two interesting questions. How much history should there be in oral history? And how comprehensive, how sort of monumental does it need to be? And my sense is that it can be, but it also doesn't necessarily need to be. My hope is that because porn and oral history is a bit of a silly joke, that people can kind of carry that pinch of saltness into the reading of the text itself, because I think that sort of sets a good precedent for approaching the conversations. Not to say that the conversations themselves are like extremely lighthearted, because often they're not, but they are, you know, there is a lot of humour.
There's a bit in the book that's interesting, where you're talking to a guy who works at a library, and he talks about how people come into the library and they watch porn on the computers at the library, and there's nothing he can do about that. And then one of the reasons he says there's nothing I can do about that is because he says, if we were to try and filter out porn, where would we start and stop? And he talks about a pictures of feet porn or a pictures of boobs porn. And so one thing that I wanted to ask you was, what is porn and is it even possible to define it?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. It's so interesting. Like, one of the things, I guess this is maybe just inevitable, but one of the things that happens, and it sort of happened with 50 Sounds as well, is that, you know, as soon as I sort of hit print, not that I hit print, but, you know, as soon as the book is printed, I suddenly discover this wealth of amazing knowledge that I feel like I wish I had had going into the project. And so recently, just the other day, I was watching the Netflix documentary on Pornhub that has just dropped. And one of the porn actors in there gives this definition of porn as something that you watch specifically to be sexually aroused. I was like, Oh my God.
But even that, watch, yeah. Because a lot of people.
Consume.
Yeah.
Engage with. And I think there's numerous things that I love about that definition, but one of them is that it puts the onus on the consumer, right? Like, I mean, lots of people talk in the book about various forms of literary porn, or, you know, books that they have read as porn. And I have also done this. And I think that doesn't take away from the fact that those things can be things other than porn. And some people would read them and it wouldn't even cross their minds that they could ever be porn, in a similar way that some people might look at pictures of feet on Google and not, you know, that might not occur to them.
Or the burping videos, which I'll reserve judgment.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
My jaw dropped to find out that was a thing.
Right. And even for one person, at a particular time of day, something can be literature or a reference image, and then later on in the day, it can be functioning as porn. And I feel like that's a really sort of freeing way of looking at it.
As a segue, and maybe you don't feel comfortable answering this, what is the least porny thing that you found to be porn? Maybe you don't want to answer that, though.
The least really porny thing that I found to be porn.
Because what you just said made me think of how once... it is kind of porn, but once I got off to a GIF I saw of Justin Bieber's penis, which is quite extra weird because I'm... not straight. But it was like, I saw it on Twitter and then I was like, okay, and then like later that became porn.
Wow.
Told you I was going to drop some truth bombs and this evening.
The desire to match that is so great, but I haven't got anything.
Okay, it'll come to you.
Okay.
So that's a good definition of porn. And reading the book, I thought about whether... There's a lot of talk about shame or stigma or how it feels taboo to talk or about porn or watch porn. And I wonder if that is part of what makes porn. Kind of just thinking aloud, the kind of transgressiveness of it or some of the sort of naughtiness surrounding it. If we erase all the stigma, would it still be hot to us? I don't know. I'm just thinking I don't know if you thought about that. In the same way that, you know, for a lot of people, kink is sexy in a way because it feels like transgressive. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by this question as well. I think when I was much younger, I didn't find kind of straight up porn very sexy, but the things that I did find sexy, scenes from films and stuff, were so much sexier because it felt so forbidden. And I had to find innovative ways of watching them when my parents weren't around, you know.
Like a ritual around it. Almost.
Yeah. And there's, like, someone talks, a couple of people actually talk about, like, having to adjust their TV aerial as a child in order to get this specific channel, and they would see, like, little flashes of penises amid all this, like, blur and buzz, and that was so exciting. Yeah.
I've actually heard about three different gay male friends talk about sneaking downstairs to watch Queer as Folk late at night.
Yes.
I think a lot of people had that experience, the sex scenes in that TV show, as their first porn experience. But it's, there's something about the sort of ritual of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I wonder, I don't know, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Like when people talk about sexuality, the word healthy comes up so much. Like what is healthy and what is not? And I think that there's generally an idea that healthy sexuality doesn't include kind of forms of transgression. But I'm not sure that I agree with that. It's sort of finding ways of things to feeling transgressive in a way that isn't harmful to others. I don't know.
Yeah.
The book, in the introduction, I talk about this, that the sort of one of the, I think, the events that really solidified for me that I wanted to write this book was that I got a text from someone late at night telling me that they were watching porn.
Mm.
And
it gave you the ick, kind of.
It gave me the ick, yeah. But it gave me the ick, but it also gave me the,
use
like...
the formal term.
But it also gave me the curiosity of, like, what is going on here? Like, what...
Were they not trying to start sexting you?
Maybe. Maybe they were.
Anyway.
But what my thoughts went to immediately was like, okay, is this like, porn isn't exciting enough. Watching porn isn't exciting enough. So then you text someone to tell them that you're watching porn and that someone, you know, is someone that you shouldn't be initiating sexual contact with because you're married and... I don't know.
I don't know what to do with that, so I'm just going to leave it. Maybe we can come back to that later. So, we have this idea, or it comes up in the book a bit, but I think there is a social idea that porn homogenizes sex. There are, of course, repeated tropes in porn that we see a lot and certain dynamics and... I do get that, but whenever someone says that, I also think there's so much porn out there that, in a way, I think it's personally for me, like, made my sex life more exploratory or inventive, or there's, it should, I always think, yeah, there, of course there is a sort of gendered dynamic and there is a beauty standard, but there's also so much beyond that that we maybe would never see.
Mm.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You asked earlier about what do we mean by porn? But I think there's also this question of, like, okay, when we're talking specifically about videos streamed on the internet porn, what do we mean by it?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people use porn as a shorthand essentially for, like, top page porn hub type stuff.
There's so much weird stuff on the top page of porn.
Well, okay.
Sorry, I shouldn't use the word weird, but I completely agree with you. Yeah, we're talking about it's a shorthand for a certain type of porn.
Yes, and I think, in a way, that does. My sense is, if that's all the only representation of sex that you ever see, you do end up with quite a homogenized, or at least sort of biased view of what sex looks like when people have it, and, you know, also what the people who are having sex look like, right? But then there's, like you say, there's, like, vast wildernesses, not wildernesses, the opposite of wildernesses, very, very densely populated wildernesses outside of that with so much stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, and I think for me, one of the nice things about having these conversations was, like, seeing the ways in which porn for people could be genuinely kind of creatively inspiring or facilitated conversations, you know, and I think then hearing those anecdotes would then make me remember times from my own life when it had functioned in that way, and focus less on the sort of, like, the image that pops into my head when I, certainly before beginning this book, when I hear the word porn or Pornhub.
I think that there is a certain image that pops into a lot of people's heads, and I think this book is really helpful for us to move beyond that. Because porn can be so many things. You know, it can be arousing, it can be disturbing, it can be funny.
Mm.
Sometimes I find porn quite funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking particularly of this porn channel that I discovered once called Dancing Bear. It's quite sort of surrealist. This guy kind of arrives at, so it will sort of be like a hen party setup, and he's like a male stripper, and he arrives in a bear costume, which is quite incidental to the plot. Like, he's always a bear, but I guess it's just a branding thing. And then he sort of, like, works his way around the room, and the women he's naked and the women are all clothed, which I think I quite like, because, like, that's
a
and then they're sort of looking really disinterested, and they sort of clap, like this, really half-heartedly. It's the strangest, funniest thing. And then at the end, he'll sort of select one of the women and have sex with her in front of the whole, the hen party.
Wow.
Yeah. But I find it so ludicrously funny that I have returned to it. I sent it to someone I know and they were like, this is like an Alan Partridge type of thing situation. So sex can be many things, but I think it can, when we talk about porn being, you know, when we think of porn as problematic, it seems in the book that it comes up again and again that when it becomes problematic is the idea of when there's a blurred line between fantasy and reality, or when people go down that rabbit hole of searching for things that are more and more extreme. Mm. But fantasy and reality was an interesting thing in the book because there's a few ways that it sort of manifests. And one is there's the fantasy of what we see on screen and then there's the reality of the working conditions or what's happening behind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then there's the line between seeing what we were just talking, what I was saying, the line between seeing and doing. Mm. So are you able to separate what you're seeing from something that you shouldn't do? And then also fantasy versus reality in terms of how porn can tilt our expectations of what sex is and what sex should be in a way that can be quite negative. Someone in the book says, are we just acting out porn every time we have sex? Where's the pleasure? Fantasy and reality.
Yeah. I think there are a few conceptual issues like this, I guess, that, you know, before going into the book, I was like, oh yeah, the interplay between fantasy and reality will come up. But I think what surprised me was that it came up in some form in every conversation that I had, and sometimes multiple times, and from so many different angles. Mm. And the kind of the causal vectors that join those two things, right? Like you were saying, there's the issue of fantasy and reality within the production of porn, but just thinking about the consumer, how much our reality as it is shaped by the sociocultural forces that shape us dictates what it is that we fantasize about. Yeah. And then when those sort of sociocultural forces are also shaping the fantasies that we get to see, how much does that then affect us? And yeah, like with the scripts, the are we acting out porn every time we have sex? If that's all we're seeing and we're not having any kind of diversity in those scripts, and, you know, inevitably more and more with kids, like, they're going to be watching porn before they have any kind of sexual experience at all. So then, you know, that's the model through and through.
Yeah.
How is that shaping, what we, like, what we do, but also what we fantasize about in terms of for our own sex lives?
I think there's this sort of us and them thing with that, isn't there? Is that because I would probably think, oh, I'm not going to do something just because I saw it in porn. Like, I have that filter, whereas someone else might not. But that's not necessarily true. Like, I don't know to what extent. It's the chicken and egg thing that you bring up in the book quite a lot. I don't know how things would be different because they're not different.
And
I think that's probably true of anyone who consumes porn to some extent, to varying extents.
And I think, like, to come back to this, like, healthy, these sort of what people say in quite prescriptive ways about what constitutes healthy sexuality or otherwise, you know, there's also this interesting thing of, like, if you are healthy sexually, like, should the sex that you are having, the things that you're doing in your sex life, resemble the kind of things that people are doing in the porn that you watch? And I think some people would say yes. And then others would say
no.
And that actually sort of porn is a time when you can try on possibilities that you wouldn't necessarily want to try on for yourself.
Yes.
Either because they don't feel safe or they don't feel compatible with your sort of conception of your identity or for whatever reason. Mm. Yeah.
That's true. And that actually brings me onto something that frustrated me a little bit reading that came up again and again, which was this idea, and I totally understand what's meant by it, but this idea that people kept saying, you know, oh, it feels like porn's for men, or porn is made for men. And of course, so much of it is. Even formally, the way that it's shot, yeah, from the way it's shot, you know, male POV or whatever,
right.
To what actually happens and the narrative.
Yeah.
But I think so many women are watching the same porn. Mm. So is it for men, or are we sort of giving something over by saying, I don't know if that's my perspective as a queer person as well, though, because maybe at times I'm identifying with the woman, at times I'm identifying with the man. And maybe if I was a straight woman, I'd have a different experience. I would really feel like, oh, this does feel like it was made for men about a lot of the things I see. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an interesting group of issues. I mean, I think one of the times that thing of porn being made for men comes up most often in the book is in relation to lesbian porn, right? That women wanting to get off to lesbian porn, but actually finding it quite off-putting because it feels like it's for men.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And kind of still like carries a lot of heterosexual tropes, or sort of is playing to the male gaze. Mm-hmm. For anyone here who hasn't looked at the Pornhub, like they publish these kind of these annual reports of who is watching their porn and kind of do analysis of the statistics there. It's absolutely fascinating. And I think in 2022, 46% of gay male porn on Pornhub is watched by women. And that's just like, that's just one
46% of gay male porn
is watched by women on Pornhub. And that's just one example.
And that's because women don't want to see any women being subjugated.
I think it is. Mm-hmm. But when overall it's something like 27% of videos on Pornhub are watched by women. So, which is all just to say, porn is definitely not for men in the sense that it's only men who are watching it. I think the interesting question is like, what does it mean even within that for porn to still feel like it's being made for men and yet women watching it? And are that 27% who are watching it feeling that way? Or is it people who feel like it's for men who then turn to other forms, either or like outside of those kind of classic streaming sites, you know, or written or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Feels like there's a bit of a through line of with a lot of the straighter people you talk to in the book, like hetero pessimism coming through when you talk about, which is interesting. I don't know how to define heteropessimism on the spot, but you can probably guess.
Do you feel that
the performative distancing of oneself from heterosexuality is a bit as one kind of reading of it, I don't know, but yeah.
But do you feel that
it would be so much better to be queer, you know?
Do you feel that from the men as well, or just from the women?
From the women. Yeah. There are a few comments that are made.
I
think I sort of just wrote it in the margins a few times. But I suppose a conversation, there's also a bit of a double standard from some of the women. You know, they watch porn, but they don't want to know that their partner does. But I understand that. I feel like maybe you even said something at some point to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Effect.
Yeah.
What was it?
I don't know what I said.
Well, maybe when you were young. You don't know what you said in the book. Maybe you were younger and a partner had told you about watching porn or something, and
I mean, you were
quite grossed out by it or something, but you were younger, so I think you said you feel differently now.
Yeah, and I don't think that grossed out is quite
the right term.
Phrase, like threatened in some way, and sort of, I think what comes up a lot in that, in the book, and I definitely identify with this, is people who are in, women who are in relationships with men are really frightened to No. Yeah, to bring up the conversation because they're scared that it will reveal this reality that they don't feel like they have the capacity to kind of accommodate, or it will like fundamentally shift something that they think about their partner. Mm-hmm. And I think
you can't unlearn it once you know it. It's like you can't unsee it. Yeah. Or you wouldn't be able to get it out of your head.
And I think that's really interesting. Like in the lead up to working on this book, I try to avoid reading too many kind of academic-y type texts about porn because I didn't want to have a sort of knowledge imbalance with the people I was talking to. But I did watch a few films, and there's, you know, there's one, I forget the name of it, but there's one where there's a guy who's a porn addict, and this becomes kind of clear to his girlfriend, and like the shock and the horror. A man, in fact, what becomes clear is not that he's an addict, it's just that he's watched it once.
Oh.
And like the shock and the horror, you know, and this kind of, this real idea that like women are princesses who need to sort of live in this fantasy world.
Yeah, I've not experienced that in a same-sex relationship, but I can imagine that it's different in a straight relationship if you're... Because of the gender dynamic, and
did you find
that men were therefore a bit shy about talking about their porn habits because they were like, I don't want to seem problematic or something?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that's definitely a dynamic that goes on. Yeah,
which keeps it shrouded in secrecy. But I think one of the nice things about porn is it is something that you can. It is quite private, and it's like something you can have for yourself. And there aren't that many other things.
I totally agree. And I like the way that kind of privacy was referenced in the books. In the book? Book. Like, you know, and there's one guy who is married and has kids, and we were talking during lockdown, and he was basically saying, you know, I don't really have much time for myself. Mm. Like, when I can kind of be in that creative space and porn is a way for me to sort of retreat into myself and my kind of inner world in some way, which is not how I necessarily would have thought about it before, but it was, somehow great to hear it being described in that way. I think what I would like to sort of say on that is, you know, when that started coming up, I started thinking, okay, is this then... Does this stand in contradiction with my general, well, certainly the takeaway of this book, but also my general feeling that we should talk about porn more? You know, like, does keeping it, retaining it as a private realm then mean not conversing about it? Like, either with friends, you know, in general, in society, or, like, within our relationships. And I think over time I kind of came to a place where I was feeling quite strongly, no. Like, you can still talk about it and be open with it while having it as a space to yourself. In the same way, sorry, this is a crass example, but, like, you know, if you have, like, an artistic practice, like, you might talk about it with your friends and your partner, but... You still are going into the studio by yourself and, you know, immersing in that world, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that he sort of thought of it as time to himself. I think there's a lot more, that we're going to see a lot more of kind of the wellnessification of porn in the future, which will be good in some ways, probably. It will probably lead to more...
What, like masturbating is good for you?
It
helps.
Yeah, I mean, we're already at the point where, you know, you can get a jade egg... thing or a silver vibrate, you know, like Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes.
Trending topic.
Yeah.
been hawking that stuff around. I think that porn, you know, will... Ethical porn is almost kind of positioned. Some types of, like, Eric List or whatever is kind of positioned more in that way.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's... Some people will feel really good about that, and that will be really positive in some ways. In the same way that now you can go to, you can probably like look up a sex party on Time Out or something, you know, or on Field, people are listing their kink preferences like it's, I like dog walking, you know, like, and that is good in some ways, but some people will just be split on that. I'm like, about that. I'm like, keep it all gross and taboo. But
well, this
would
I feel like
it would change more in the future, I suppose. Yeah. I think that's what you're getting at as well. Because the funny thing is, you talk to people about, I watched a porn marathon with my flatmates, or I went to a virtual strip club during lockdown. So I think we can see that happening.
It is happening. And this comes back to your earlier question about the sort of the transgressiveness in a way. And I feel like those, the transgressiveness and the privacy relate in an interesting way. I mean, there's one conversation in that book with someone where she talks about she lives in California and how there's like this great, drive to do, like, be very open about things and, like, have, you know, workshops and everything and, like, fisting workshops and so on. And she finds that, like, the most objectionable thing. And I sort of put that...
she finds that objectionable.
Yeah, and I sort of... I mean, I have a horror of those kind of group situations in conjunction with anything intimate anyway.
Yeah.
But I think... I do think that there is something to be said for keeping some of this stuff private.
Yeah. Sorry, I just started laughing because I was just thinking about like this, what this future could be like, and then I envisaged a brand partnership with Dancing Bear. It's like Dancing Bear sponsored by Lemsip or something like that.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
We're going to come to Q&A in just a sec, but I have two more questions. Something I really liked about the book is that you left in a lot more of the kind of, I don't want to say problematics, I'll say trickier stuff.
Mm.
Where people say things that they definitely wouldn't say if they were in the LRB. No, if they weren't anonymous. So
if they weren't nervous, did you say?
If they weren't anonymous.
Anonymous,
so
yes.
Is there anything that you felt, oh, I really can't publish that? Or was it all just went in?
There was stuff about me.
Right, I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah.
That's because, the nice thing about editing the book.
Right.
You can take that out.
And I don't, you know, I want to be totally straight up about this. You know, the conversations that I had with people usually lasted like an hour and a half. And I had 19 of them. So like, they are edited for sure.
Yeah.
And I edited a lot of me out because, I mean, for various reasons, partly because I repeated myself a lot and I felt like it would make the reading experience intolerable. And also I wanted to sort of put the spotlight on my interlocutors, but also, you know, they are anonymous and my name is on the cover and there are certain things, like given the topic being the topic and the way that people respond to respond to sort of women writing about sex in general. I felt like I wanted to keep some of it under wraps.
Yeah.
There are also a couple of bits where, I don't know, there's a bit in one conversation where someone talks about the Italian porn producer in the States, who I think he said to him, how do you continue to be aroused by this stuff? Like, where does it end up? And the guy says, dwarfs. And I mean, that stayed in there. And it felt sort of important in some way to stay true to the horrible
thing.
Degrees of objectification that this topic can take you to.
Yeah,
you know, and the horribleness of the conversations sometimes.
Yeah,
because that is also a truth about it.
Yeah,
I guess.
We need to go to the audience. I wanted to ask a bit about sort of the ethics of porn, but maybe someone will ask about that. So, does anyone have a question for Polly?
Hi, thank you. I would love to know how you prepared for these many, many conversations.
Thank you. I didn't, really. Before beginning the project at all, I made a list of sort of possible, not necessarily questions, but like topics that I felt I wanted to address, aspects of porn. But then as the conversations went on, I mean, I was going to say with the first conversation, but the first conversation I had was actually with someone that I'm really close to, so that didn't come up as much. But then the second one, I think I went in and it was too much on my mind. And it sort of started to feel at times like I was entering more into an interviewer type mode, which was something that I felt from the outset I really wanted to avoid. I wanted it to be reciprocal. And so I then sort of tried to put that out of my mind as much as possible. And, you know, I mean, having said that, there are still formulaic elements to them, obviously. And there were a couple of questions. I mean, the hardest thing that I found was starting. So there were a couple of like go-to questions that I began with, but then I tried to let the conversation just sort of run naturally from there, if I could.
Thank you so much. I heard you speak about someone being shocked at their partner having like watched porn, but like not actually kind of addressing their kind of addiction to porn that they mentioned. And I was wondering how you think you can keep the privacy and the kind of pleasure that you can experience in porn while being able to kind of speak to and address porn addiction in a way that doesn't kind of trivialize it.
Speak to the pleasure of porn while not trivializing the affliction that can be porn addiction. I mean, it's a really good question. In a way, I sort of feel like I sort of wasn't really, I don't consider myself a porn expert, and I don't feel like I want to make any pronouncements about what porn is. You know, in a way, I'm just presenting the 19 people that I talked to and what they said. And, you know, some of them touch on addiction. And I really recognize that that is a serious issue. And I don't think that that would occur, it could occur, really, if there wasn't also some sort of pleasure inherent in it. But I suppose I don't really feel qualified to make an overarching pronouncement on how those two should intersect, if that makes sense.
Hi. First of all, just say thank you for the book. It sort of articulated quite a lot of my own thoughts in a really well, in a good way. My question is, I guess, the difference between good porn and bad porn. I'm just going to preface that with that. When you talked about what is the definition of porn, and said that some things can be porn that aren't really porn, they sort of art one or whatever, but, and then I thought, well, is there such a thing as pure porn? And I think there probably is. We probably say there's some things that are, but are they? Are they completely irredeemable? So is even the porn that is totally, you know, made for just sexual gratification, aesthetic in any way? And I was also interested in the end of your book. You kind of end up talking about the difference between the erotic and porn. Yeah. But I kind of thought, is that just, are we just talking about good porn and bad porn? As in, it's erotic when you like it, when it's good for you. What is my question? My question is, what is the difference between the erotic and porn, or between good porn and bad porn? What can we narrow it down, or is it purely a personal pleasure question?
A subjective thing. Thank you for that. Like, I feel like in the afterword, I talk about the erotic versus the pornographic as they occur in Audre Lorde's Uses for the Erotic. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about that essay is, like, she really makes clear that for her, the erotic is not just about sex. And it's not living erotically for her doesn't stop at, you know, sort of having a fulfilled sex life in what we would kind of modernly consider that to be. It's much more about sort of being congruent and feeling embodied and sort of feeling. I suppose maybe the best way to formulate it, how I conceive of it, although I don't think she specifically formulates it in those terms, is a question of compartmentalization or like dissociation. So when you are engaging in something erotically, it's with your whole being. And I think for her, the pornographic is very much not that. And I have a desire to say that probably good porn and bad porn, to the extent that you can define them in a way that transcends the subjective, kind of comes down to that in a way, like something that you could stand behind even when you weren't feeling porny and say like, okay, yeah, this is what I watch. I'm okay with that, you know? And obviously that kind of desire to, like, as soon as you're done, be done, you know, get the porn that you're watching away from your sight, like, also is to do with shame. But I think there is also, like, this, it does tie into this kind of dissociation and compartmentalization.
Thank you so much for your time this evening. It's been very interesting. I wanted to ask about the kind of reconciliation that has been mentioned a few times about talking more about porn but keeping it private. Mm. And because that seems to be the main crux almost. And I guess my question is, how much do you think as a society we should talk about porn, and how should we talk about that? Because one of the issues about bad and good porn, it seems, is that the bad porn filters into the real life bedrooms of men who are conditioned, and women as well, but largely men who are conditioned to behave in very misogynistic ways sexually. Mm. For me personally, I think a lot of it has to do with consent and education. And my question to you is, do you think we should talk about porn in schools? Do you think we should educate children around the realities of porn, how porn is made, why it is made? Because one of the things that was raised, and going back to the dwarf's point, and going back to a question Amelia asked about transgression, when do you stop acting out on the porn that you're seeing? Mm. And you talk about dwarves. Dwarves are real people who have real sex. And a concern I have is that they're deemed to be something that you shouldn't engage with in real life because it's a fetish. Mm. And I think that's something kids need to hear. And so that's a rant. My question is, do you think we should educate children about porn in schools?
No, don't be sorry. Yes, I do. I really, really do. You know, I mean, we get to this ridiculous place, right, where last week a head teacher in Florida resigned because she or someone at her school had shown the kids a picture of Michelangelo's David, which is deemed pornographic. And, that's ridiculous for a number of reasons, but I don't know the exact age of the kids involved, but the average age for a child to watch porn now in the UK is 9. So the likelihood is these kids had seen porn already. And I think that the more that we don't talk about it in schools and don't acknowledge it, we drive, it becomes this very, very strange dichotomy between what is acknowledged and the reality. And I feel like that's really, really pernicious. I mentioned in the introduction to this book that my dad mentioned pornography to me on the phone. And the reason that he mentioned pornography to me on the phone is because he has a son who's in senior school. And the parents had been asked to go in for a kind of convention, not convention, sorry, a meeting about porn. sorry, I don't know why I said convention. A meeting about porn where basically they said, look, your kids are going to be watching porn. It's a fact. What's really important is to counteract that. And what they suggested was to show them various TV series, one of which was Normal People on BBC. No comment. But anyway, which is to say, and I found that quite heartening because at least there is some acknowledgement going on. As far as I'm concerned, I feel like the more acknowledgement, the better. I struggle to see what harm talking about porn could do in schools that would possibly outweigh the good that it would do. Although, you know, I also understand that that is a tricky pill to swallow for people who are still in denial about the prevalence and the effect.
Hey, thanks so much. I have a question about porn as sort of such an animating topic, I guess, like generation by generation. Yeah. Mia Srinivasan, I think when she was here, was talking about how when she was talking to her students, she was quite surprised that they really were engaged by and sort of wanted to critically think through waves of feminist thought that she thought had kind of been either sidelined or just not that engaged with. And I guess, what is it that makes a topic so ripe for relitigation generation after generation?
Thank you for that question. I mean, I want to give quite a basic answer, which is because it is a taboo to really speak about it. And yet it is something that is just, I mean, reading what Amir Srinivasan writes about her students, you can see that they feel like it's really a big looming presence in their lives, and it's really shaping the sex and the even the sort of interactions that they're having outside of sex, and yet it's not really acknowledged. And so I feel like that is the draw of it, really, is just to kind of grasp the nettle that we still, I still feel like we are unwilling to grasp. Although I will say, something that I will say is, what has been amazing to me is now I seem to be talking about porn all the time. And I don't just mean like in the LRB. It's like something has shifted, I think, probably in my embarrassment levels. And I tell people that I'm working on this or, you know, have worked on this. And suddenly, like, it's like a dam has broken. And so I think the fact that we don't speak about it doesn't mean that, I think my presumption is that people didn't speak about it because they really didn't want to speak about it. But I think there is a real desire to talk about it. It's just, it's hard to be the first one to broach that topic.
Does she say, I can't quite remember, but does she, Amir Srinivasan, say that her students she's also quite surprised because they're quite sort of sympathetic to Andrea Dworkin.
Yes.
And that was partly as well because bad things had happened with image sharing or bad experiences during sex or rape culture.
And, yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting to read that. It was quite sort of depressing.
That Billie Eilish article as well, right?
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book. I haven't actually read that.
Okay. Where she talks about it's a Guardian article where she basically says, like, I was watching porn from the age of 11 and it, like, led me down the route to have some very bad sex. And by bad sex, she doesn't mean unenjoyable sex. She means sort of, I think, issues with consent and violence and stuff.
Right.
Hiya.
Hi.
I think I just wanted to ask, I kind of noticed that nobody was really using the word violence when they were talking about like transgressive sex or, you know, the gentleman mentioned before that really great question about what is the impact of young people, especially watching what can be quite violent sex without any sort of other context contributing to that voyeurism. That was my first question. And also, I guess sex work as well, like sex work is part of pornography, and that's something as well that we've not touched upon yet. And I would be interested to hear thoughts on both of those.
Thank you for those questions, by the way, because I would have loved to ask about both things. So
I mean, I feel like this ties so neatly in with the question before. The violence is real, right? And I think you're right. An issue that comes up again and again, another issue that comes up again and again in the book, right? This sort of tension between wanting to appear sex positive, appear non-judgmental, appear open, appear progressive, while at the same time acknowledging the violence that is inherent in a lot of porn and a lot of what I want to call mainstream porn, while knowing that that's a loaded and difficult and problematic term. And yes, again, like you say, within sex work as well, like I fully acknowledge that those are things that need to be more openly discussed. And I think that probably one of the reasons that we don't talk about porn more is because that tension is so huge. But I guess I feel like it's not going to go away without a discussion of it first.
There's different types of violence too, right? Because there's actual sort of physical violence that you see, that you might see in porn. I rarely encounter that. But then there's also the sort of more insidious type of violence of the gender dynamics or that porn can...
Yeah.
So there's different types of violence totally. As well, I think.
Yeah.
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 Okay. Thank you so much, everyone, for your questions. And thank you, Holly. It's such a big topic. There's so many more things that I want to talk about. Yeah. But we covered quite a lot of ground. So thank you very much. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.